I was wearing. But I didn't say so. It would have only confused us both. I drove up the mile-a-minute highway that Thursday afternoon. This time I didn't need to buy a hat when I got to Derry because I'd remembered to add a nice summer straw to the purchases I made at Mason's. I registered at the Derry townhouse, had a meal in the dining room, then went into the bar and ordered a beer from Fred Toomey. On this go-round, I made no effort to engage him in conversation. The following day I rented my old apartment on Harris Avenue, and far from keeping me awake, the sound of the descending planes actually lulled me to sleep. The day after that I went down to Macon's Sporting Goods and told the clerk I was interested in buying a handgun because I was in the real estate business and blah, blah, blah. The clerk brought out my .38 police special and once more told me it was a fine piece of protection. I bought it and put it in my briefcase. I thought about walking out Kansas Street to the little picnic area so I could watch Richie from the Ditchy and Bevy from the Levee practice their jump street moves, then realized I'd missed them. I wished I'd thought to check the late November issues of the Daily News during my brief return to 2011. I could have found out if they'd won their talent show. I made it a habit to drop into the Lamplighter for an early evening beer before the place started to fill up. Sometimes I ordered lobster pickens. I never saw Frank Dunning there, nor wanted to. I had another reason for making the Lamplighter a regular stop. If all went well, I'd soon be heading for Texas, and I wanted to build up my personal treasury before I went. I made friends with Jeff, the bartender, and one evening toward the end of September, he brought up a subject I'd been planning to raise myself. "Who do you like in the series, George?" "Yankees, of course," I said. "You say that? A guy from Wisconsin?" "Home state pride has nothing to do with it. The Yankees are a team of destiny this year." "Never happen. Their pitches are old. Their defense is leaky. Mantle's got bad wheels. The Bronx Bomber dynasty is over. Milwaukee might even sweep." I laughed. "You make a few good points, Jeff. I can see you're a student of the game, but fess up, you hate the Yanks just like everybody else in New England. And it's destroyed your perspective." "You want to put your money where your mouth is?" "Sure, a fin. I make it a point not to take any more than a 5-spot from the wage slaves. Are we on?"
"We are."
And we shook on it. "Okay," I said, "now that we've got that accomplished, and since we're on the subjects of baseball and betting, two great American pastimes, I wonder if you could tell me where I could find some serious action in this town. If I may wax poetic, I want to lay a major wager. Hey, bring me another beer and draw one for yourself." I said major wager, you know, the main style. And he laughed as he drew a couple of Narragansetts, which I'd learned to call Nasty Gansett. When in Rome, one should as much as possible speak as the Romans do. We clinked glasses, and Jeff asked me what I meant by serious action. I pretended to consider, then told him.
500 smacks? On the Yankees? When the Braves have got Spahn and Burdett? Not to mention Hank Aaron and Steady Eddie Matthews? You're nuts!
Maybe yes, maybe no. We'll see starting October 1st, won't we? Is there anyone in Derry who'll fade a bet of that size? Did I know what he was going to say next? No. I'm not that prescient. Was I surprised? No, again, because the past isn't just obdurate. It's in harmony with both itself and the future. I experienced that harmony time and again.
Chaz Fratty. You've probably seen him in here. He owns a bunch of hack shops. I wouldn't exactly call him a bookie, but he keeps plenty busy at World Series time and during high school football and basketball season.
And you think you'll take my action?
Sure. Give you odds and everything. Just...
He looked around, saw we still had the bar to ourselves, but dropped his voice to a whisper anyway. Just don't stiff him, George. He gnaws people. Strong people.
I hear you, I said.
Thanks for the tip. In fact, I'm going to do you a favor and not hold you to that 5. When the Yankees win the series. The following day, I entered Chaz Fratty's Mermaid Pawn and Loan, where I was confronted by a large, stone-faced lady of perhaps 300 pounds. She wore a purple dress, Indian beads, and moccasins on her swollen feet. I told her I was interested in discussing a rather large sports-oriented business proposal with Mr. Fratty.
"Is that a bet in regular talk?"
she asked. "Are you a cop?" I asked.
"Yes,"
she said, bringing a tipperillo out of one dress pocket and lighting it with a Zippo.
"I'm J. Edgar Hoover, my son."
"Well, Mr. Hoover, you got me. I'm talking about a bet.
World Series or Tigers football?"
"I'm not from town and wouldn't know a dairy tiger from a banger baboon. It's baseball." The woman stuck her head through a curtained-off doorway at the back of the room, presenting me with what was surely one of Central Maine's largest backsides, and hollered,
"Hey, Chazzy, come out here! You got a live one!"
Fratty came out and kissed the large lady on the cheek. "Thank you, my love." His sleeves were rolled up, and I could see the mermaid. "May I help you?" "I hope so. George Amberson's the name." I offered my hand. "I'm from Wisconsin, and although my heart's with the hometown boys, when it comes to the series, my wallet's with the Yankees." He turned to the shelf behind him, but the large lady already had what he wanted, a scuffed green ledger with personal loans on the front. He opened it and paged to a blank sheet, periodically wetting the tip of his finger.
"How much of your wallet are we talking about, cuz?"
"What kind of odds could I get on 500 to win?" The fat woman laughed and blew out smoke.
"On the Bombers? Even up, cuz. Strictly even up."
"What kind of odds could I get on 500 Yankees in 7? He considered, then turned to the large lady. She shook her head, still looking amused.
"Won't go," she said. "If you don't believe me, send a telegram and check the line in New York."
I sighed and drummed my fingers on a glass case filled with watches and rings. "Okay, how about this? 500, and the Yankees come back from 3-1. He laughed.
"Some sense of humor, cuz. Just let me consult with the boss."
He and the large lady, Fratty looked like a token dwarf next to her, consulted in whispers. Then he came back to the counter.
"If you mean what I think you mean, I'll take your action at 4-1. But if the Yankees don't go down 3-1 and then bounce all the way back, you lose the bundle. I'd just like to get the terms of the wages straight."
"Straight as can be," I said. "And no offense to either you or your friend."
"We're married,"
the large lady said.
"So don't call us friends."
And she laughed some more. "No offense to either you or your wife, but 4-1 doesn't make it. 8-1, though. Then it's a nice piece of action for both sides."
"I'll give you 5-1, but that's where it stops," Fratty said. "For me, this is just a sideline. You want Vegas, go to Vegas."
7? I said. "Come on, Mr. Fratty, work with me on this." He and the large lady conferred. Then he came back and offered 6-1, which I accepted. It was still low odds for such a crazy bet, but I didn't want to hurt Fratty too badly. It was true that he'd set me up for Bill Turkett, but he'd had his reasons. Besides, that was in another life. Back then, baseball was played as it was meant to be played, in bright afternoon sunshine, and on days in the early fall when it still felt like summer. People gathered in front of Benton's appliance store down in the Lowtown to watch the games on 3 21-inch zeniths perched on pedestals in the show window. Above them was a sign reading, "Why watch on the street when you can watch at home? Easy credit terms." Oh, yes, easy credit terms. That was more like the America I had grown up in. On October 1st, Milwaukee beat the Yankees 1-0. Behind Warren Spahn. On October 2nd, Milwaukee buried the Bombers 13-5. On the 4th of October, when the series returned to the Bronx, Don Larson blanked Milwaukee 4-0 with relief help from Ryan Duren, who had no idea where the ball was going once it left his hand and consequently scared the living shit out of the batters who had to face him. The perfect closer, in other words. I listened to the first part of that game on the radio in my apartment and watched the last couple of innings with the crowd gathered in front of Benton's. When it was over, I went into the drugstore and purchased Kaopectate, probably the same giant economy-sized bottle as on my last trip. Mr. Keene once more asked me if I was suffering a touch of the bug. When I told him that I felt fine, the old bastard looked disappointed. I did feel fine, and I didn't expect that the past would throw me exactly the same Ryan Duren fastballs, but I felt it best to be prepared. On my way out of the drugstore, my eye was attracted by a display with a sign over it that read, "Take home a little bit of Maine." There were postcards, inflatable toy lobsters, sweet-smelling bags of soft pine duff, replicas of the town's Paul Bunyan statue, and small decorative pillows with the dairy standpipe on them, the standpipe being a circular tower that held the town's drinking water. I bought one of these. "For my nephew in Oklahoma City," I told Mr. Keene. The Yankees had won the third game of the series by the time I pulled into the Texaco station on the Harris Avenue extension. There was a sign in front of the pumps saying, "Mechanic on duty 7 days a week. Trust your car to the man who wears the star." While the pump jockey filled the tank and washed the Sunliner's windshield, I wandered into the garage bay, found a mechanic by the name of Randy Baker on duty, and did a little dickering with him. Baker was puzzled, but agreeable to my proposal. $20 changed hands. He gave me the numbers of both the station and his home. I left with a full tank, a clean windshield, and a satisfied mind. Well, relatively satisfied. It was impossible to plan for every contingency. Because of my preparations for the following day, I dropped by the lamplighter for my evening beer later than usual. But there was no risk of encountering Frank Dunning. It was his day to take his kids to the football game in Orono, and on the way back they were going to stop at the 95er for fried clams and milkshakes. Chaz Fratty was at the bar, sipping rye and water. "You better hope the Braves win tomorrow, or you're out 500, he said. They were going to win, but I had bigger things on my mind. I'd stay in Derry long enough to collect my $3,000 from Mr. Fratty, but I intended to finish my real business the following day. If things went as I hoped, I'd be done in Derry before Milwaukee scored what would prove to be the only run they needed in the sixth inning. "Well," I said, ordering a beer and some lobster pickins, "we'll just have to see, won't we?" "That's right, cuz. It's the joy of the wager. Mind if I ask you a question?" "Nope, just as long as you won't be offended if I don't answer." "That's what I like about you, cuz, that sense of humor. Must be a Wisconsin thing. What I'm curious about is why you're in our fair city." "Real estate, I thought I told you that." He leaned close. I could smell Vitalis on his slick back hair and Sen-Sen on his breath. "And if I said possible mall site, would that be a bingo?" So we talked for a while, but you already know that part. I've said I stayed away from the lamplighter when I thought Frank Dunning might be there because I already knew everything about him that I needed to know. It's the truth, but not all of the truth. I need to make that clear. If I don't, you'll never understand why I behaved as I did in Texas. Imagine coming into a room and seeing a complex, multi-story house of cards on the table. Your mission is to knock it over. If that was all, it would be easy, wouldn't it? A hard stamp of the foot or a big puff of air, the kind you muster when it's time to blow out all the birthday candles, would be enough to do the job, but that's not all. The thing is, you have to knock that house of cards down at a specific moment in time. Until then, it must stand. I knew where Dunning was going to be on the afternoon of Sunday, October 5th, 1958, and I didn't want to risk changing his course by so much as a single jot or tittle. Even crossing eyes with him in the lamplighter might have done that. You could snort and call me excessively cautious. You could say such a minor matter would be very unlikely to knock events off course. But the past is as fragile as a butterfly's wing. Or a house of cards. I'd come back to Derry to knock Frank Dunning's house of cards down, but until then, I had to protect it. I bade Chaz Fratty good night and went back to my apartment. My bottle of kaopectate was in the bathroom medicine cabinet, and my new souvenir pillow with the standpipe embroidered on it in gold thread was on the kitchen table. I took a knife from the silverware drawer and carefully cut the pillow along a diagonal. I put my revolver inside, shoving it deep into the stuffing. I wasn't sure I'd sleep, but I did, and soundly. Do your best, and let God do the rest, is just one of many sayings Christie dragged back from her AA meetings. I don't know if there's a God or not. For Jake Epping, the jury's still out on that one, but when I went to bed that night, I was pretty sure I'd done my best. All I could do now was get some sleep and hope my best was enough. There was no stomach flu. This time, I awoke at first light with the most paralyzing headache of my life. A migraine, I supposed. I didn't know for sure because I'd never had one. Looking into even dim light produced a sick, rolling thud from the nape of my neck to the base of my sinuses. My eyes gushed senseless tears. I got up, even that hurt. Put on a pair of cheap sunglasses I'd picked up on my trip north to Derry, and took 5 aspirin. They helped just enough for me to be able to get dressed and into my overcoat, which I would need. The morning was chilly and gray, threatening rain. In a way, that was a plus. I'm not sure I could have survived in sunlight. I needed a shave, but skipped it. I thought standing under a bright light, one doubled in the bathroom mirror, might cause my brain simply to disintegrate. I couldn't imagine how I was going to get through this day. So I didn't try. One step at a time, I told myself as I walked slowly down the stairs. I was clutching the railing with one hand and my souvenir pillow with the other. I must have looked like an overgrown child with a teddy bear. One step at a time. The banister snapped. For a moment I tilted forward, head thudding, hands waving wildly in the air. I dropped the pillow, the gun inside clunked, and clawed at the wall above my head. In the last second before my tilt would have become a bone-breaking tumble, my fingers clutched one of the old-fashioned wall sconces screwed into the plaster. It pulled free. But the electrical wire held just long enough for me to regain my balance. I sat down on the steps with my throbbing head on my knees. The pain pulsed in sync with the jackhammer beat of my heart. My watering eyes felt too big for their sockets. I could tell you I wanted to creep back to my apartment and give it all up, but that wouldn't be the truth. The truth was I wanted to die. Right there on the stairs, and have done with it. Are there people who have such headaches not just occasionally but frequently? If so, God help them. There was only one thing that could get me back on my feet, and I forced my aching brains not just to think of it but see it. Tugga Dunning's face suddenly obliterated as he crawled toward me, his hair and brains leaping into the air. "Okay," I said. "Okay. Yeah. Okay." I picked up a souvenir pillow and tottered the rest of the way down the stairs. I emerged into an overcast day that seemed as bright as a Sahara afternoon. I felt for my keys. They weren't there. What I found, where they should have been, was a good-sized hole in my right front pants pocket. It hadn't been there the night before. I was almost sure of that. I turned around in small, jerky steps. The keys were lying on the stoop in a litter of spilled change. I bent down, wincing, as a lead weight slid forward inside my head. I picked up the keys and made my way to the Sunliner. And when I tried the ignition, my previously reliable Ford refused to start. There was a click from the solenoid. That was all. I had prepared for this eventuality. What I hadn't prepared for was having to drag my poisoned head up the stairs again. Never in my life had I wished so fervently for my Nokia. With it, I could have called from behind the wheel, then just sat quietly with my eyes closed until Randy Baker came. Somehow, I got back up the stairs, past the broken banister and the light fixture that dangled against the torn plaster like a dead head on a broken neck. There was no answer at the service station. It was early, and it was Sunday, so I tried Baker's home number. "He's probably dead," I thought. "Had a heart attack in the middle of the night, killed by the obdurate past, with Jake Epping as the unindicted co-conspirator." My mechanic wasn't dead. He answered on the second ring, voice sleepy, and when I told him my car wouldn't start, he asked the logical question. "How'd you know yesterday?" "I'm a good guesser," I said. "Get here as soon as you can, okay? There'll be another 20 in it for you, if you can get it going." When Baker replaced the battery cable that had mysteriously come loose in the night, maybe at the same moment that hole was appearing in the pocket of my slacks, and the Sunliner still wouldn't start, he checked the plugs and found two that were badly corroded. He had extras in his large green toolkit, and when they were in place, my Chariot roared to life. "It's probably not my business, but the only place you should be going is back to bed, or to a doctor. You're as pale as a ghost." "It's just a migraine. I'll be okay. Let's look in the trunk. I want to check the spare." We checked the spare. Flat. I followed him to the Texaco through what had become a light, steady drizzle. The cars we passed had their headlights on, and even with the sunglasses, each pair seemed to bore holes through my brain. Baker unlocked the service bay and tried to blow up my spare. No go. It hissed air from half a dozen cracks, almost as fine as pores in human skin. "Huh," he said. "Never seen that before. Tire must be defective." "Put another one on the rim," I said. I went around to the back of the station while he did it. I couldn't stand the sound of the compressor. I leaned against the cinder block and turned my face up, letting cold mist fall on my hot skin. "One step at a time," I told myself. "One step at a time." When I tried to pay Randy Baker for the tire, he shook his head. "You already gave me half a week's pay. I'd be a dog to take Ma. I'm just worried you'll run off the road or something. Is it really that important?"
"Sick relative."
"You're sick yourself, man."
I couldn't deny it.
I drove out of town on Route 7, slowing to look both ways at every intersection, whether I had the right-of-way or not. This turned out to be an excellent idea, because a fully loaded gravel truck blew through a red at the intersection of 7 and the Old Dairy Road. If I hadn't come to an almost complete stop in spite of a green light, my Ford would have been demolished, with me turned a hamburger inside it. I laid on my horn in spite of the pain in my head, but the driver paid no attention. He looked like a zombie behind the wheel. "I'll never be able to do this," I thought. But if I couldn't stop Frank Dunning, how could I even hope to stop Oswald? Why go to Texas at all? That wasn't what kept me moving, though. It was the thought of Tugga that did that. Not to mention the other three kids. I had saved them once. If I didn't save them again, How could I escape the sure knowledge that I had participated in murdering them just by triggering another reset? I approached the dairy drive-in and turned into the gravel drive leading to the shuttered box office. The drive was lined with decorative fir trees. I parked behind them, turned off the engine, and tried to get out of the car. I couldn't. The door wouldn't open. I slammed my shoulder against it a couple of times, and when it still wouldn't open, I saw the lock was pushed down, even though this was long before the era of self-locking cars, and I hadn't pushed it down myself. I pulled on it. It wouldn't come up. I wiggled it. It wouldn't come up. I unrolled my window, leaned out, and managed to use my key on the door lock below the chrome thumb button on the outside handle. This time the lock popped up. I got out, then reached in for the souvenir pillow. Resistance to change is proportional to how much the future might be altered by any given act, I had told Al in my best school lecture voice, and it was true. But I'd had no idea of the personal cost. Now I did. I walked slowly up Route 7, my collar raised against the rain and my hat pulled low over my ears. When cars came, they were infrequent, I faded back into the trees that lined my side of the road. I think that once or twice I put my hands on the sides of my head to make sure it wasn't swelling. It felt like it was. At last, the trees pulled back. They were replaced by a rock wall. Beyond the wall were manicured rolling hills dotted with headstones and monuments. I had come to Longview Cemetery. I breasted a hill, and there was the flower stand on the other side of the road. It was shuttered and dark. Weekends would ordinarily be busy visiting the dead relatives' days, but in weather like this, business would be slow, and I suppose the old lady who ran the place was sleeping in a little bit. She would open later, though. I'd seen that for myself. I climbed the wall, expecting it to give way beneath me, but it didn't. And once I was actually in Longview, a wonderful thing happened. The headache began to abate. I sat on a gravestone beneath an overhanging elm tree, closed my eyes, and checked the pain level. What had been a screaming 10, and maybe even turned up to 11, like a spinal tap amplifier, had gone back to 8. "I think I broke through, Al," I said. "I think I might be on the other side." Still, I moved carefully, alert for more tricks, falling trees, grave robbing, thugs, maybe even a flaming meteor. There was nothing. By the time I reached the side-by-side graves marked Althea Pierce Dunning and James Allen Dunning, the pain in my head was down to a 5. I looked around and saw a mausoleum with a familiar name engraved on the pink granite, Tracker. I went to it and tried the iron gate. In 2011 it would have been locked, but this was 1958, and it swung open easily, although with the horror movie squall of rusty hinges. I went inside, kicking my way through a drift of old brittle leaves. There was a stone meditation bench running up the center of the vault. On either side were stone storage lockers for trackers going all the way back to 1831. According to the copper plate on the front of that earliest one, the bones of Monsieur Jean-Paul Treisch lay within. I closed my eyes, lay down on the meditation bench, and dozed. Slept. When I woke up, it was close to noon. I went to the front door of the Tracker vault to wait for Dunning, just as Oswald, 5 years from now, would no doubt wait for the Kennedy motorcade and his shooter's blind on the 6th floor of the Texas Schoolbook Depository. My headache was gone. Dunning's Pontiac appeared around the same time Red Shane Dinst was scoring that day's winning run for the Milwaukee Braves. Dunning parked on the closest feeder lane, got out, turned up his collar, then bent back in to get the flower baskets. He walked down the hill to his parents' graves, carrying one in each hand. Now that the time had come, I was pretty much okay. I had gotten on the other side of whatever had been trying to hold me back. The souvenir pillow was under my coat. My hand was inside. The wet grass muffled my footsteps. There was no sun to cast my shadow. He didn't know I was behind him until I spoke his name. Then he turned around. "When I'm visiting my folks, I don't like company," he said. "Who the hell are you, anyway? And what's that?" He was looking at the pillow, which I had taken out. I was wearing it like a glove. I chose to answer the first question only. "My name's Jake Epping. I came here to ask you a question." "So ask and then leave me alone." Rain was dripping off the brim of his hat. Mine too. "What's the most important thing in life, Dunning?"
"What?"
"To a man, I mean."
"What are you, wacky? What's with the pillow, anyway?"
"Humor me. Answer the question." He shrugged.
"His family, I suppose."
"I think so, too," I said, and pulled the trigger twice. The first report was a muffled thump, like hitting a rug with a carpet beater. The second was a little louder. I thought the pillow might catch on fire. I saw that in Godfather II. But it only smoldered a little. Dunning fell over, crushing the basket of flowers he'd placed on his father's grave. I knelt beside him, my knee squelching up water from the wet earth, placed the torn end of the pillow against his temple, and fired again, just to make sure. I dragged him into the tracker mausoleum and dropped the scorched pillow on his face. When I left, a couple of cars were driving slowly through the cemetery, and a few people were standing under umbrellas at gravesites, but nobody was paying any attention to me. I walked without haste toward the rock wall, pausing every now and then to look at a grave or monument. Once I was screened by trees, I jogged back to my Ford. When I heard cars coming, I slipped into the woods. On one of those retreats, I buried the gun under a foot of earth and leaves. The sunliner was waiting undisturbed where I'd left it, and it started on the first crank. I drove back to my apartment and listened to the end of the baseball game. I cried a little, I think. Those were tears of relief, not remorse. No matter what happened to me, the Dunning family was safe. I slept like a baby that night. There was plenty about the World Series in Monday's Derry Daily News, including a nice pic of Shane Dinst sliding home with the winning run after a Tony Kubek error. According to Red Barber's column, the Bronx Bombers were finished.
"Stick a fork in 'em," he opined. "The Yanks are dead. Long live the Yanks!"
Nothing about Frank Dunning to start Derry's workweek. But he was front-page material in Tuesday's paper, along with a photo that showed him grinning with the ladies' love-me good cheer. His devilish George Clooney twinkle was all present and accounted for. Businessman found murdered in local cemetery. Dunning was prominent in many charity drives. According to the Derry chief of police, the department was following up all sorts of good leads, and an arrest was expected soon. Reached by phone, Doris Dunning declared herself to be shocked and devastated. There was no mention of the fact that she and the decedent had been living apart. Various friends and co-workers at the Center Street Market expressed similar shock. Everyone seemed in agreement that Frank Dunning had been an absolutely terrific guy, and no one could guess why someone would want to shoot him. Tony Tracker was especially outraged, possibly because the corpse had been found in the family body bank.
"For this guy, they ought to bring back the death penalty," he said.
On Wednesday, the 8th of October, the Yankees squeezed out a 2-1 win over the Braves at County Stadium. On Thursday, they broke a 2-2 tie in the 8th, scoring 4 runs and closing the series out. On Friday, I went back to the Mermaid Pawn and Loan, expecting to be met there by Mrs. Grump and Mr. Gloom. The large lady more than lived up to my expectations. She curled her lip when she saw me and shouted, "Chazzy, Mr. Moneybags is here!" Then she shoved through the curtained-off doorway and out of my life. Fratty came out wearing the same chipmunk grin I'd first encountered in the lamplighter on my previous trip into Derry's colorful past. In one hand, he was holding a well-stuffed envelope with G. Amberson printed on the front.
"There you are, cuz," he said, "big as life and twice as handsome. And here's your loot. Feel free to count it."
"I trust you," I said, and put the envelope in my pocket. "You're mighty cheery for a fellow who just forked over 3 large.
"I won't deny that you cut into this year's fall classic take," he said. "Seriously cut into it. Although I still made a few bucks. I always do. But I'm mostly in the game because it's a, what do you call it, public service. People are going to bet. People are always going to bet. And I give them a prompt payoff when a payoff's due. Also, I like taking bets. It's a kind of hobby with me. And do you know when I like it best? No. When someone like you comes along, a real stampeder, who bucks the odds and comes through. That restores my faith in the random nature of the universe."
I wondered how random he'd think it was if he could see Al Templeton's cheat sheet. "Your wife's view doesn't appear to be so, Catholic." He laughed, and his small black eyes sparkled. Win, lose, or draw, the little man with the mermaid on his arm flat out enjoyed life. I admired that.
"Oh, Marjorie? When some sad sack comes in here with his wife's engagement ring and a sob story, she turns into a pile of goo. But on the sportsbook stuff, she's a different lady. That she takes personal. You love her a lot, don't you, Mr. Fratty? Like the moon and the stars, cuz. Like the moon and the stars."
Marjorie had been reading that day's paper, and it was still on the glass-topped counter containing the rings and things. The headline read, "Hunt for Mystery Killer Goes On as Frank Dunning is Laid to Rest." "What do you reckon that was about?" I asked.
"Dunno, but I'll tell you something."
He leaned forward, and the smile was gone.
"He wasn't the saint the local rag is making him out to be. I could tell you stories, cuz."
"Go ahead, I've got all day." The smile reappeared.
"Nah, in Derry we keep ourselves to ourselves."
"So I've noticed," I said. I wanted to go back to Cosset Street. I knew the cops might be watching the Dunning house to see if anyone showed an unusual interest in the family, but the desire was very strong just the same. It wasn't Harry I wanted to see, it was his little sister. There were things I wanted to tell her. That she should go out trick-or-treating on Halloween, no matter how sad she felt about her daddy. That she'd be the prettiest, most magical Indian princess anyone had ever seen, and would come home with a mountain of candy. That she had at least 53 long and busy years ahead of her, and probably many more. Most of all, that someday her brother Harry was going to want to put on a uniform and go for a soldier, and she must do her very, very, very best to talk him out of it. Only, kids forget. Every teacher knows this. And they think they're going to live forever. It was time to leave Derry, but I had one final little chore to take care of before I went. I waited until Monday. That afternoon, the 13th of October, I threw my valise into the Sunliner's trunk, then sat behind the wheel long enough to scribble a brief note. I tucked it into an envelope, sealed it, and printed the recipient's name on the front. I drove down to the Lowtown, parked, and walked into the sleepy Silver Dollar. It was empty except for Pete, the bartender, as I had expected. He was washing glasses and watching Love of Life on the boob tube. He turned to me reluctantly, keeping one eye on John and Marcia, or whatever their names were.
What can I get you?
Nothing, but you can do me a favor. For which I will compensate you to the tune of $5 American. He looked unimpressed.
Really, what's the favor?
I put the envelope on the bar. Pass this over when the proper party comes in. He looked at the name on the front of the envelope.
What do you want with Billy Turkett? And why don't you give it to him yourself?
It's a simple enough assignment, Pete. Do you want the five or not?
Sure. Long as it won't do no harm. Billy's a good enough soul.
It won't do him any harm. It might even do him some good. I put a fin on top of the envelope. Pete made it disappear and went back to his soap opera. I left. Turkett probably got the envelope. Whether or not he did anything after he read what was inside is another question. One of many to which I will never have answers. This is what I wrote. Dear Bill, there is something wrong with your heart. You must go to the doctor soon, or it'll be too late. You might think this is a joke, but it is not. You might think I couldn't know such a thing, but I do. I know it as surely as you know Frank Dunning murdered your sister Clara and your nephew Mikey. Please believe me and go to the doctor. A friend. I got into my Sunliner, and as I backed out of the slant parking slot, I saw Mr. Keene's narrow and mistrustful face peering out at me from the drugstore. I unrolled my window, stuck out my arm, and shot him the bird. Then I drove up Mile Hill and out of Derry for the last time. Chapter 11. As I drove south on the mile-a-minute highway, I tried to convince myself that I needn't bother with Carolyn Poulin. I told myself she was Al Templeton's experiment, not mine, and his experiment, like his life, was now over. I reminded myself that the Poulin girl's case was very different from that of Doris, Troy, Tugga, and Ellen. Yes, Carolyn was going to be paralyzed from the waist down, and yes, that was a terrible thing. But being paralyzed by a bullet is not the same as being beaten to death with a sledgehammer. In a wheelchair or out of it, Carolyn Poulin was going to live a full and fruitful life. I told myself it would be crazy to risk my real mission by yet again daring the obdurate past to reach out, grab me, and chew me up. None of it would wash. I had meant to spend my first night on the road in Boston. But the image of Dunning on his father's grave with the crushed basket of flowers beneath him kept recurring. He had deserved to die. Hell, needed to. But on October 5th, he had, as yet, done nothing to his family. Not to his second one, anyway. I could tell myself, and did, that he'd done plenty to his first one. That on October 13th of 1958, he was already a murderer twice over, one of his victims little more than an infant. But I had only Bill Turkett's word for that. I guess in the end I wanted to balance something that felt bad, no matter how necessary, with something that felt good. So instead of driving to Boston, I got off the turnpike at Auburn and drove west into Maine's Lakes region. I checked into the cabins where Al had stayed just before nightfall. I got the largest of the four waterside accommodations at a ridiculous off-season rate. Those 5 weeks may have been the best of my life. I saw no one but the couple who ran the local store where I bought a few simple groceries twice a week and Mr. Winchell, who owned the cabins. He stopped in on Sundays to make sure I was okay and having a good time. Every time he asked, I told him I was, and it was no lie. He gave me a key to the equipment shed, and I took a canoe out every morning and evening when the water was calm. I remember watching the full moon rise silently over the trees on one of those evenings and how it beat a silver avenue across the water, while the reflection of my canoe hung below me like a drowned twin. A loon cried somewhere and was answered by a pal or a mate. Soon others joined the conversation. I shipped my paddle and just sat there 300 yards out from shore, watching the moon and listening to the loons converse. I remember thinking if there was a heaven somewhere, and it wasn't like this, then I didn't want to go. The fall colors begin to bloom, first timid yellow, then orange, then blazing, strumpet red, as autumn burned away another Maine summer. There were cardboard boxes filled with coverless paperbacks at the market, and I must have read 3 dozen or more. Mysteries by Ed McBain, John D. MacDonald, Chester Himes, and Richard S. Prather. Steamy melodramas like Peyton Place and A Stone for Danny Fisher. Westerns by the score, and one science fiction novel called The Lincoln Hunters, which concerned time travelers trying to record a forgotten speech by Abraham Lincoln. When I wasn't reading or canoeing, I was walking in the woods. Long autumn afternoons, most, hazy and warm. Dusty gilded light slanting down through the trees. At night, a quiet, so vast it seemed almost to reverberate. Few cars passed on Route 114, and after 10 o'clock or so, there were none at all. After 10, the part of the world where I had come to rest belonged only to the loons and the wind in the fir trees. Little by little, the image of Frank Dunning lying on his father's grave began to fade, and I found myself less likely to recall at odd moments how I had dropped the souvenir pillow still smoldering over his staring eyes in the Tracker mausoleum. By the end of October, as the last of the leaves were swirling down from the trees and the nighttime temperatures began to dip into the 30s, I started driving into Durham, getting the lay of the land around Bowie Hill, where a shooting was going to occur in another 2 weeks. The Friends meeting house Al had mentioned made a convenient landmark. Not far past it, a dead tree was leaning toward the road, probably the one Al had been struggling with when Andrew Cullum came along, already wearing his orange hunting vest. I also made it a point to locate the accidental shooter's home and to trace his probable course from there to Bowie Hill. My plan was no plan at all, really. I just follow the trail Al had already blazed. I'd drive to Durham early in the day, park near the fallen tree, struggle with it, then pretend to have a heart attack when Cullum came along and pitched in. But after locating Cullum's house, I happened to stop for a cold drink at Brownie's store half a mile away and saw a poster in the window that gave me an idea. It was crazy, but sort of interesting. The poster was headed Androscoggin County Cribbage Tournament Results. There followed a list of about 50 names. The tourney winner from West Minot had scored 10,000 pegs, whatever they were. The runner-up had scored 9,500. In third place, with 8,722 pegs, the name had been circled in red, which was what drew my attention in the first place, was Andy Cullum. Coincidences happen, but I've come to believe they're actually quite rare. Something is at work, okay? Somewhere in the universe or behind it, a great machine is ticking and turning its fabulous gears. The next day, I drove back to Cullum's house just shy of 5 in the afternoon. I parked behind his Ford Woody station wagon and went to the door. A pleasant-faced woman wearing a ruffled apron and holding a baby in the crook of her arm opened to my knock, and I knew, just looking at her, that I was doing the right thing. Because Carolyn Poulin wasn't going to be the only victim on the 15th of November, just the one who'd end up in a wheelchair. "Yes?" "My name's George Amberson, ma'am." I tipped my hat to her. "I wonder if I could speak to your husband?" "Sure I could." He'd already come up behind her and put an arm around her shoulders. A young guy, not yet 30, now wearing an expression of pleasant inquiry. His baby reached for his face, and when Cullum kissed the kid's fingers, she laughed. Cullum extended his hand to me, and I shook it. "What can I do for you, Mr. Amberson?" I held up the cribbage board. "I noticed at Brownies that you're quite the player. So I have a proposal for you." Mrs. Cullum looked alarmed. "My husband and I are Methodists, Mr. Amberson. The tournaments are just for fun. He won a trophy, and I'm happy to polish it for him so it looks good on the mantle. But if you want to play cards for money, you've come to the wrong household." She smiled. I could see it cost her an effort, but it was still a good one. I liked her. I liked both of them. "She's right," Cullum sounded regretful but firm. "I used to play penny a peg back when I was working at the woods, but that was before I met Marnie." "Oh, I'd be crazy to play you for money," I said, "because I don't play at all. But I want to learn." "In that case, come on in," he said. "I'll be happy to teach you. Won't take but 15 minutes, and it's an hour yet before we eat our dinner. Shoot a pickle. If you can add to 15 and count to 31, you can play cribbage." I'm sure there's more to it than a little counting and adding, or you wouldn't have placed third in the Androscoggin tournament, I said. "And I actually want a little more than just to learn the rules. I want to buy a day of your time. November the 15th, to be exact. From 10 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, let's say." Now his wife began to look scared. She was holding the baby close to her chest. "For those 6 hours of your time, I'll pay you $200. Cullum frowned. "What's your game, mister?" "I'm hoping to make it cribbage." That, however, wasn't going to be enough. I saw it on their faces. "Look, I'm not going to try and kid you that there isn't more to it, but if I tried to explain, you'd think I was crazy."
"I think that already," Marnie Cullum said. "Send him on his way, Andy."
I turned to her. "It's nothing bad. It's nothing illegal. It's not a scam, and it's not dangerous. I take my oath on it." But I was starting to think it wasn't going to work, oath or no oath. It had been a bad idea. Cullum would be doubly suspicious when he met me near the Friends' meeting house on the afternoon of the 15th. But I kept pushing. It was a thing I'd learned to do in Derry.
"It's just cribbage," I said. "You teach me the game, we play for a few hours, I give you $200, and we all part friends. What do you say?"
"Where are you from, Mr. Amberson?"
"Upstate in Derry, most recently. I'm in commercial real estate. Right now I'm vacationing on Sebago Lake before heading back down south. Do you want some names? References, so to speak?" I smiled. "People who tell you I'm not nuts."
"He goes out in the woods on Saturdays during hunting season," Mrs. Cullum said. "It's the only chance he gets because he works all week, and when he gets home it's so close to dark it doesn't even pay to load a gun."
She still looked mistrustful, but now I saw something else on her face that gave me hope. "When you're young and have a kid, when your husband works manual labor, which his chapped, calloused hands said he did, $200 can mean a lot of groceries. Or, in 1958, 2.5 house payments."
"I could miss an afternoon in the woods," Cullum said. "Town's pretty well hunted out anyway. The only place left where you can get a damn deer is Bowie Hill."
"Watch your language around the baby, Mr. Cullum," she said. Her tone was sharp, but she smiled when he kissed her cheek.
"Mr. Amberson, I need to talk to my wife," Cullum said. "Do you mind standing on the stoop for a minute or two?"
"I'll do better than that," I said. "I'll go down to Brownies and get myself a dope." That was what most Derryites called sodas.
"Can I bring either of you back a cold drink?"
They declined with thanks, and then Marnie Cullum closed the door in my face. I drove to Brownies, where I bought an orange crush for myself and a licorice whip I thought the baby might like, if she was old enough to have such things. The Cullums were going to turn me down, I thought, with thanks, but firmly. I was a strange man with a strange proposal. I had hoped that changing the past might be easier this time because Al had already changed it twice. Apparently that wasn't going to be the case. But I got a surprise. Cullum said yes, and his wife allowed me to give the licorice to the little girl, who received it with a gleeful chortle, sucked on it, then ran it through her hair like a comb. They even invited me to stay for the evening meal, which I declined. I offered Andy Cullum a $50 retainer, which he declined, until his wife insisted that he take it. I went back to Sebago feeling exultant, but as I drove back to Durham on the morning of November 15th, the fields white with a frost so thick that the orange-clad hunters who were already out in force left tracks, my mood had changed. He will have called the state police, or the local constable, I thought, and while they're questioning me in the nearest police station, trying to find out what kind of a loony I am, Cullum will be off hunting in the Bowie Hill woods. But there was no police car in the driveway, just Andy Collum's Ford Woody. I took my new cribbage board and went to the door. He opened it and said, "Ready for your lesson, Mr. Amberson?" I smiled. "Yes, sir, I am." He took me out to the back porch. I don't think the missus wanted me in the house with her and the baby. The rules were simple. Pegs were points, and a game was two laps around the board. I learned about the right jack, double runs, being stuck in the mud hole, and what Andy called Mystic 19, the so-called impossible hand. Then we played. I kept track of the score to begin with, but quit once Cullum pulled 400 points ahead. Every now and then some hunter would bang off a distant round, and Cullum would look toward the woods beyond his small backyard. "Next Saturday," I said on one of these occasions. "You'll be out there next Saturday for sure." "It'll probably rain," he said, then laughed. "I should complain, huh? I'm having fun and making money. And you're getting better, George." Marnie gave us lunch at noon, big tuna sandwiches and bowls of homemade tomato soup. We ate in the kitchen, and when we were done, she suggested we bring our game inside. She had decided I wasn't dangerous after all. That made me happy. They were nice people, the Cullums. A nice couple, with a nice baby. I thought of them sometimes when I heard Lee and Marina Oswald screaming at each other in their low-end apartments, or saw them, on at least one occasion, carry their animus out onto the street. The past harmonizes. It also tries to balance, and mostly succeeds. The Cullums were at one end of the seesaw. The Oswalds were at the other. And Jake Epping, also known as George Amberson, he was the tipping point. Toward the end of our marathon session, I won my first game. 3 games later, at just a few minutes past 4, I actually skunked him and laughed with delight. Baby Jenna left right along with me, then leaned forward from her high chair and gave my hair a companionable tug. "That's it," I cried, laughing. The three Cullums were laughing right along with me. "That's the one I stop on." I took out my wallet and laid 3 50s down on the red and white checked oilcloth covering the kitchen table. "And worth every cent." Andy pushed it back to my side. "Put it in your billfold where it belongs, George. I had too much fun to take your money." I nodded as if I agreed, then pushed the bills to Marnie, who snatched them up. "Thank you, Mr. Amberson." She looked reproachfully at her husband, then back at me. "We can really use this." "Good." I got up and stretched, hearing my spine crackle. Somewhere 5 miles from here, maybe 7, Carolyn Poulin and her father were getting back into a pick-em-up with Poulin Construction and Carpentry painted on the door. Maybe they'd gotten a deer, maybe not. Either way, I was sure they'd had a nice afternoon in the woods, talking about whatever fathers and daughters talk about, and good for them. "Stay for supper, George," Marnie said. "I've got beans and hot dogs." So I stayed, and afterward we watched the news on the Cullum's little table model TV. There had been a hunting accident in New Hampshire, but not in Maine. I allowed myself to be talked into a second dish of Marnie's apple cobbler, although I was full to bursting, then stood and thanked them very much for their hospitality.